With a membership of only around 100, it's one of the most exclusive clubs on Earth. In fact, more people have been to outer space than have earned their way into this, the ultimate travel club. According to the United Nations, there are 193 sovereign nations in the world. Welcome to the only podcast that brings you the stories from the dedicated few who've spent their lives on the singular quest of traveling to them all. Welcome to Counting Countries with your host, Rick Gazarian.
Hey now, thank you for joining me on Counting Countries. I'm your host, Rick Gazarian, and today I'm speaking with Johnny Blair. Johnny and I caught up on Skype while he was in Poland, I was in Boston. I've known about Johnny for a couple of years from reading his blog and known him personally on social media the last year or so. So it was great to catch up with him for the podcast. Johnny's been on the road for nearly a decade and a half and has covered a lot of ground. Johnny was inspired to travel by both ice cream and football. He sold ice cream as a kid, and his co-workers hailed from 20 different countries, opening his eyes to the world. Johnny's other passion is football, and as a kid, he collected stickers of World Cup competitors from around the world. Johnny loves travel, and he has a special interest in micronations. Johnny has met Jonathan One, Emperor of Austenasia, and was the first backpacker to visit this micronation. He also visited the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, a unique political and geographical entity. Johnny shares stories of traveling to New Zealand and partaking in adventure sports and meeting tons of other travelers. He explains the challenges of traveling in China and the rewards that are earned by visiting this amazing nation. He shares with us the beauty of Afghanistan and his discomfort when visiting Venezuela. Johnny, who's been to 113 countries, is a well-known travel blogger. You can check out his blogs, Northern Irishman in Poland, and don'tstopliving.net. Please take a moment to review the episode on iTunes or wherever you listen to, and please enjoy the conversation. Johnny, welcome to Counting Countries. I'm hoping you can introduce yourself to us.
Hi, Rick. Yeah, it's good to be here on the podcast. I'm Johnny Blair. I come from Northern Ireland. I grew up in Newton Ards there. And since then, I've done a lot of traveling. So obviously, it's a passion of mine. As well as travel, I love football, soccer, as some people know it, and I also love writing. I just love to write about anything, whether it's writing a poem, writing about a football match, writing about some strange or obscure site or a hotel or a bar. So, yeah, big passionate traveler, and I love football as well.
Johnny, okay, great. Thanks for that little overview there. And I want to take us back to Northern Ireland where you grew up. And I want to know about your family. So basically, I want to know all things travel about you. And I want to know if travel was part of your life as a kid growing up with your family.
Well, actually, it wasn't really a big part of my life when I was young. It sort of developed over time. I mean, when I was 11, I actually went away on my own without my parents because the school had a trip. So I went on that trip from Northern Ireland to Amsterdam to the Netherlands. It was my first time on my own. And that developed a bit of a passion for me. My family don't really travel that much. They've done a bit of traveling, of course, like many families do. But no, there was definitely none of that with my mum and dad or my two brothers and sister. They all kind of, they're in the UK at the moment and they're not really doing much traveling. So I guess I was like the black sheep, the odd one out.
So touching on that first trip as an 11-year-old, any impressions or did that really open your eyes to traveling overseas and looking at different cultures?
Yeah, I just thought it was brilliant. I mean, as soon as I got off the airplane in Holland or the Netherlands, you know, I was using Dutch guilders, which was the currency then. I was seeing that the people were speaking differently. They were eating different food. They were dressing different. the architecture was different, the religion, you know, everything just looked so different. You know, Amsterdam to Belfast, we were in Volendam as well, and a few other places, Delft. And always, it just appeared to me that travel just opens your mind to something that's alien, something that's new and isn't present in your hometown.
I agree with that sentiment. And you just, I heard you mention a term, black sheep. How many years yeah. have you been on the road approximately?
Well, I officially left my home town about 14 years ago. And when I left that day, I had no idea that I'd be away for 14 years and with no idea to go back. But in that 14 years, I've lived in a few different places, so it hasn't been just a journey. I did my degree first, so that took up at least the first 3 years. Then I did a round the world trip and returned to London in England. And then after that, I relocated to Australia. Then I relocated to China or Hong Kong, and now I'm back in Europe, actually. So it's been a progression, but it has been about 14 years, which has been quite, you know, hardcore away from Northern Ireland and just discovering what's out there in the world, you know, just so many places in the last 14 years.
Okay, and back to black sheep. I was actually curious to know the feelings or impressions of your family in regards to what you did compared to your two other siblings. So were they supportive? Did they think you had gone crazy? Were they hoping you were going to come back after 3 months? What was your family's impression or feelings in regard to your excessive travel?
I guess probably everything you mentioned there was going through their mind. You know, probably they thought, oh, he'll be back soon. You know, I'm definitely the black sheep. And I'm the least settled one out of my siblings. I have two brothers and a sister, and I've also got a nephew. But, you know, I guess people have their own lives, whether it's my mom or dad or my brothers or sisters or my childhood friends. We make our own decisions in life, and we ultimately decide where we want to go and what we want to do. I didn't actually have a conscious decision not to return there. It was just that I was so busy, you know, away from home that it never really became an option to go back. It was just, oh, where can I go next? You know, and even today I'll look something up on the internet and go, wow, I've never seen that before. I'd love to go and visit that place. So it's a progression, and I guess all my family, they're probably happy for me if I'm having a good time and happy, but probably we miss each other as humans do, you know?
Yep. Nope. That's obviously one of the biggest challenges, missing family and friends back home. What, so we know you left, when you were 11 years old to go check out Holland. What was kind of your next first, solo trip after that? Maybe when you're a bit older?
To be honest, there was a bit of a break. I mean, I went to a few rock concerts in my teenage years, like when I was like 15, 16, 17. I also went to, you know, Spain, France and England in my teenage years. But it wasn't really until I was in my early 20s that I did proper, you know, sort of long term travel on my own. So I would say, even though I did the 11-year-old trip, it took me a while. I think I was quite busy working, trying to make sure I had enough money before I was traveling. Okay. And then obviously once I had a bit of money, I was able to go.
Okay, so tell me about that first, shall we say, proper trip in your early 20s when you started to do some more serious travel.
Well, I would say it started in England when I was at university. I was working by the beach selling ice cream. And when I went into work one day, I noticed that out of the 20 people I worked with, we had like 15 different nationalities. So one by one, I wanted to know about their culture and visit them. When I think back on that, Poland is probably the first real trip then, which is ironic because I live here now. That was the real trip that would have been kind of just spontaneous and you know, done because I'd met people that were Polish when I was working in that job. So I would say that was the first main trip, and then after that it would have been New Zealand and China. So Poland was the first one.
Okay, so I'm thinking of your history, family that didn't travel, went on a great school trip when you're 11. Couple rock shows, So where'd this passion travel bug, where did it start? Where did it come from then to make you want to, you know, hit the road?
To be honest, it actually dated back even before that, because I love football so much. I would always buy the football sticker album for the World Cup. And I remember in the 1986 World Cup, Northern Ireland actually qualified for that World Cup. So we had two pages in the book. And I remember going through all the other teams in that book, looking at their pages, going, oh, I'd love to go there. And it was countries that qualified that time, like South Korea, Argentina, Uruguay, Iraq, Brazil, etc. So when I looked back to my childhood, there was always an idea that I wanted to visit all those places. It was just a case of getting the money and the plan together. I guess I was a bit of a slow starter then. I wanted to travel, but I did it little by little. And then in the last 10 years, I've totally made up for probably the teenage years when I didn't really travel as much.
Okay, so you talked about your first kind of road trip in the 20s, or series of road trips, Poland, New Zealand, etc.
Yeah.
So talk to me, you graduated from university, I believe, and then you started incorporating travel more and more into your life. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I actually graduated quite late. I'd already done a lot of traveling by the time I graduated, because I ended up during the course. Degree, I broke my arm and I broke my leg, so I was deferred actually for 2 years. So the ironic thing is, during one of those 2 years was the trip when I went to China, I think China, Russia and Belarus, and that was, I just came away from university for a while, and then I went back into it and finally graduated when I was 28, which is quite old for United Kingdom graduates anyway.
You must have stuck out a little bit.
Yeah, especially because I had a broken leg about 3 months before I actually went up to collect the award, you know, the graduation. So, it was a kind of topsy-turvy degree I did. I mean, I got it in the end, but it was it definitely wasn't plain sailing.
Okay, so tell me, I guess, from early 20s till 28, share with us one of your bigger, more interesting, more impactful road trips you took during that time period.
Honest, when I look back, there would be two from that period. One was definitely New Zealand, because when I got to New Zealand, I just felt the freedom of it all, because I went skydiving, I did bungee jumping, I did all these adventure sports, and at night I was just, you know, staying in different hostels, meeting, you know, 20 people per day, 20 new people, 20 new Facebook friends per day, you know, real people that I met in life and traveled with them, you know, roomed together with them. So New Zealand was a big eye-opener because it was just so free and liberal. And then I went to China, and China was kind of the opposite because it was so complicated. I couldn't understand any maps. I was reading things, trying to work out how to get to the next city, and it just made me really, you know, have to work hard to be a traveler. New Zealand was easy, right, because I just got off a flight, and you go and organize things. China was the test. That was the sort of, I realized that if I really wanted to travel hardcore, I needed to be able to do things that were well outside of my culture and outside of my comfort zone. So China is a big eye-opener for me, probably the game changer.
Okay, so looking at New Zealand, that's one of my big gaps. I so need to visit that country. In terms of natural beauty, which I hear is stunning, what would be a highlight for you for a natural beauty experience memory in New Zealand?
Natural beauty. You've got the Tongariro crossing, which is, to be honest, it's famous for being in a movie. And I can't remember because I'm not good with movies, but I think it was Lord of the Rings was filmed there. So I did that crossing. And then in the South Island, you've got these glaciers, and they're beautiful. So I did a few day hikes there. And then obviously you've got the likes of Wellington as well, which is a city that has a mountain overlooking it. So the natural beauty is there, but also the cultural diversity of life in New Zealand is also pretty awesome.
And you just mentioned China and how important or life-changing that trip was. Do you appreciate, do you like the puzzle-solving aspect of traveling to a country like that? Does that frustrate you, or do you find that rewarding?
It's definitely the second one there. It's definitely rewarding. It's absolutely mind-blowing, because if you really want to go and do something, you'll do it. You know, your mind will take you there. So if you get you know, to China, you can't read anything. You have to just start somewhere. So you book into a hostel. You talk to other people in the hostel. Find out how they did it. You then might pick up a few words, you know, how to say thank you, how to order a beer, what time is the train leaving. And the challenge is what I buzz off. Those types of, I mean, New Zealand, to be honest, was too easy because, you know, anyone, literally anyone can go to New Zealand or Australia if they speak English. And it's an easy country to travel. Is that test. And once I'd realized I was in China and could do it, I then started looking at other obscure countries that were a little bit not so touristic and also challenging. Of course, I wanted to challenge. I wanted, you know, how difficult is a visa to get? How can I communicate to local people who don't speak any English? And how can I travel to places in the middle of the countryside where there's no public transport? So just places like that, really, I buzz off them now. But China ultimately started that passion.
Johnny, curious, what year were you in China and how long did you spend there approximately?
Okay, so my first trip to China would have been 2007, which was only China. I didn't go to Hong Kong or Macau, and I had a one-month visa. I didn't use all of it, so I just stayed for a few weeks. I had a passion for China at the time, and that was just my first trip to China. I've actually been 20 times now. It's one of the countries that I've been to the most times. I think the longest I spent there in one go was probably not my first trip. It was probably my fourth or fifth trip when I hiked around the province, where I solely did that province, you know, the Tiger Leaping Gorge hike, Lijiang Old Town, and the mountains down in the south near the Vietnam border. So, yeah, it was a huge life-changing trip to go to China, but it made me want to go there more and more times. So it's still on my list, China, every time I think of travel, because there are so many parts of it that I still haven't been to. You know, it's huge.
Infinite. So why the passion? I mean, 20 times, that's awesome. That's impressive. What's driving you to go to that country so often?
I was actually based in Hong Kong for about 5 years. And while I was there, I decided that I should try and visit every province in China. And unfortunately, I stopped when I got to 13 provinces out of the 29. So there's still a part of me that wants to go back and, you know, work my way through the other 16. But China is quite easy now for me to travel in because I've gone to much more difficult and challenging and, you know, stricter destinations since then. So it's not that I'm returning to China anytime soon. It's that I'm kind of leaving it there, that I knowing I will go back. I've got a whole load of other places I want to go to now in the meantime before I return to China again. Because like I say, China is easy enough for me to travel in now. Well, you know, once you've been as many times as I have, it becomes second nature.
Outside of a Beijing, Shanghai, Xi'an, where's a great place that people are not traveling to that you've discovered?
Well, I tell you what, Chongqing, which is often known as the biggest city in the world, is absolutely amazing. The river just comes in, the Yangtze River just comes in there, and it is one of the most stunning views you can get from a city. You're just overlooking the river. You've also got Yunnan province is beautiful, and Fujian province down a little bit southwest of Shanghai, there are these buildings called the Fujian Tulu. They're a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And you can literally go in and sleep in one of these buildings. And these are like circular buildings that were used to house families. So in terms of China, it's endless for me. I can't even think of any places in China that I didn't like, you know.
And share with us, let's call it one Chinese travel hack. Because, yeah, it can be a little bit more challenging once you get out of the main cities. What's a travel hack to getting around China that you discovered or utilized?
I will tell you, internal flights is a good one because people think that, oh, we'll just get a bus or train. But in China, you're wasting time when you get buses and trains. Internal flights go from, like, say, Chongqing to Guangzhou or Shenzhen. And these flights are really cheap. You go onto every different Chinese airline Even, you know, I can't even remember the names of them all. South China Airlines, China Airlines, Hong Kong Airlines. They all offer pretty good flights within China, and you can save time and money. And they also give you food. Almost every flight, internal flight in China, has food on the flight. So that would be one. I guess knowing someone with the language problem also helps, but generally I just tried to get by using guidebooks, and a few people that I spoke to along the way would help me with the language, you know.
Gotcha. Okay, Johnny, you've been to 113 of the 193 UN. What point, or how did it come to fruition that you decided I want to travel the world and go to every country in the world 193?
I guess when I'd been to about 80 countries, I looked up, you know, could I make it to 100? And then I thought, well, of course I can. It's just a case of doing that. And then once I got to 100 countries, it felt like a milestone, but it also felt that there's no need to stop once you're well over the halfway mark to visiting everywhere, well, every country. So from time to time, I just have a look at the UN list, and I just think 193. Which one? Are going to prove the most difficult, which ones would I like to visit next, and is there any logical route where it might be easier to visit five on one trip, you know, like, for example, I was in the stands, so I went to, like, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Afghanistan, five countries on one trip. So just looking at ways to kind of make it easier to visit them all. It's a progression. Obviously, I want to visit them all. It's just a case of me working out the route. And the best way that I satisfactorily believe that I've seen all that I want in those countries, I don't want to just go to a country, you know, to say, oh, that one's done, we'll go to the next one. I like to actually do something, you know, personal or selfish in that country. And that might be a football match. It might be tasting the food, just different ways that I want to visit each country.
Okay, very cool. And I noted I was on your website. You know, 193 is obviously one metric that is pretty popular. But it looks like on your website you are chasing a list of 625 places.
That's true, and obviously that's a huge list, but it's whenever, you know, governments and different parts of the world decide that they want to be a separate country, and maybe they don't have that recognized autonomy or, you know, the recognized citizenship or something from the UN, you know. So these other places, the really obscure ones, or the breakaway republics, they're also something that I'm really passionate in. I love these places. So, yeah, there's a lot of them, and I'd love to see as many of them as I can.
Yeah, I can see from, you know, speaking with you previously and checking out your website, you have a real passion for some of these other, you know, de facto countries or autonomous regions, you know, and you're doing things like Nagorno-Karabakh and Transnistria, which are pretty well known. But it also looks like, Johnny, that you have driven down one or two layers much deeper than a lot of other people in this community. So I noticed a couple things, and I'm not going to be able to pronounce this. Austenasia.
Yeah.
Okay. And I believe that's somewhere in England.
So basically it's been recognized as a separate country, you know, in the country's own eyes. So it's, you know, it's got its own empire, it's got its own you know, land, so they own it. They also have their own rules and regulations, their own political system, and many of these little micronations and breakaway republics, they want to make a little bit of money. So they have a website where they sell maybe coins or stamps, you know, or visas. So you can get your passport stamped in a lot of these crazy places. And, you know, whether that counts or not as a country, I just love the idea of it, that someone can actually do that. You know, who would rebel against the Queen of England? Austenasia, you know, they've created their own empire. The Queen's never heard of them, you know. If she has, I'd be surprised, you know.
So, and just to drill down a little bit, so Austenasia, I believe, has a population of 82 people, and it's just, is it a village? Is it a couple of houses in England? What is it exactly?
So basically, it started with one guy that decided his house was separate, But because he became so popular in the Micronations online community, other people added their houses to that community. So they're not actually geographically joined, but these other people in houses that are scattered in different parts of the world actually class themselves as Austenasians. I don't know whether it's because they thought it was cool that you could rebel against the, you know, the British Empire, or whether they just wanted something to do out of boredom, you know, or to become a king. You know, you or I could become a king today if we self-declared a republic or a kingdom. You know, we could become the president if we want. So I guess there's a bit of adventure with that, maybe just something a bit different in their lives, and they do it.
Okay, and looking at your blog, I saw a picture. It looked like when you went to Austenasia that you got to meet Jonathan the First.
Yeah, Jonathan's the emperor, really good guy. Basically, I just looked him up. I sent him an email, said, look, I'm in the area next week. Is there any chance of coming, you know, and seeing the country? And he said, yeah, sure, I'll take you to the royal palace. And he'd take me round. And he made quite a lot of effort. And in fact, at the end of that trip, he actually shook my hand and gave me this like certificate. I was actually the country's first tourist. Yeah. So, and they put that on their website, you know, we welcomed our first tourist today, because they have people going there, you know, maybe his friends or something going to visit. But I was going there for the, you know, sole purpose of being a tourist. And obviously, as a writer, I wanted to write about it and tell people, hey, did you know that there's a place that borders England that's a country? And people were looking at my story going, serious here, are you? And of course, whether I'm serious or not, it's the fact is that this is what's happening, you know. So I'm just reporting life as it happened.
Yeah, and looking at that photo, Jonathan the First looked like he was like 20 years old and looked a little bit like Harry Potter. Or?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, now he's a bit older now, and he's got married. He's actually got, there's a princess. His wife's the princess now. So it's yeah, I guess he's about 25 now, 24, 25. But, you know, that's his world and his life. And he's not the only one to be in that position. I've actually met probably about six or seven other guys or girls in the same, you know, same kind of mentality or mindset as Jonathan.
Okay, so we'll have to hear from Nomad Mania and Moose Travel people whether they want to add on Austenasia onto their list. The other place I wanted to touch on, which is another quirky place, but this one sounds a lot more, shall we say, established than Austenasia. I know you went to visit the Sovereign Military Order of Malta somewhat recently. So this is different than Malta. Tell us what the Sovereign Military Order is.
This actually took a lot of research. I'd heard about a few people saying that they went to the country, but this is actually a country with officially no land. They've actually got these knights. So these knights go back a long way, you know, knights, K-N-I-G-H-T-S, as opposed to Knights of the Week or knights, you know, when it's dark. So
these are knights from the Crusaders, right?
Exactly right. Yeah. So these date back centuries. These knights are actually genuine knights that, you know, get made a knight and they're knighted. And then they actually have somewhere where they have to live. But because this Republic of Sovereign Military Order of Malta was actually moved about a lot during its legacy, if you like, it was in Rhodes in Greece, I think it was in Cyprus, island of Malta, and eventually it got moved to Rome because a lot of it is affiliated with the Catholic Church and the Order of St. John. So they actually have a library and a base in Rome, and those are two places that you can actually go and feel that you've actually visited the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. But even more impressively, on the island of Malta, they actually have a 99-year lease on part of a palace. So you can actually go and get a behind-the-scenes guided tour of that palace. I mean, it feels like you're crossing the border into another country. It's another world. You know, you're in a knight's lair. There's one knight living there, and he, you know, that's his world. Which country is he from? Well, his passport says he's from the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. So we have to take that, you know, as that's his nationality.
Out of curiosity, do you know how that passport ranks? In other words, is it widely accepted? I'm sure you see those passport rankings, you know, ranking Singapore as number one. How does that work?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I've seen places like Singapore, Hong Kong, and Finland, you know, come quite high on this passport ranking. With their passport imagine all EU states would let them in. I'd imagine they must have some kind of deal with the US and Canada. But as for Africa and, you know, the Arabian countries and a lot of obscure islands, I guess they're in the same situation as you and I, where they'll need to apply for a visa. And when, you know, can you imagine if you lived in, I don't know, say Chad or Afghanistan, and you get a visa application from a guy from the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, you might have to question that and go, where is that?
Is that Malta? That's what he's getting at.
Interesting situation for sure.
And I don't know if you know this. What is the population, per se, of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta?
Well, I'm actually led to believe that there are only three knights, but there are over 18,000 members or something. It's quite complicated. To be honest, I'd have to check it. I know I wrote the articles about it, but sometimes when you're researching and writing things, you forget the exact figures.
Of course.
They've got a much bigger population, say in inverted commas, than you would believe. I would say it's probably bigger than the Vatican in terms of
Gotcha. Okay. Very cool, unique little slice of history still existing into present day. I want to talk a little bit about your style of travel, and I know you've been based in Poland for a while now. You were based in Hong Kong, I believe, for several years. There was one point where you were traveling for a number of years. So when you're on the road, what was your style of travel? Was it hostels and backpacking? Were you traveling solo with friends, slow, fast, airplane, point-to-point, bus? Give us a little slice of your life when you were visiting a lot of these countries.
So almost everything that you've mentioned there, Rick, to be honest, I've done all of those because I was traveling with my girlfriend for quite a while. So when we were together, we did travel together. I've also traveled with my family and friends. But if we're going to talk about most of the time, most of my travel life has been solo, and mostly it's been sort of very spontaneous. You know, I'd arrive in a city, I'd book myself a hostel for a night, get to the hostel, and then I'd sit down and go, right, where do I go from here? And I'd little by little, I would just plan each week or each day. And then if there was a visa that I had to apply for, that I also loved that because it meant that I probably had to wait around in a city, waiting for the visa. So when that was happening, I'd just end up getting a random, bus or train to any village, some remote village that day, just to go and get out and see somewhere on my own. So very much a backpacker. To condense what you've said, mostly backpacker in hostels and random spontaneous travel. But I'm also prone to a 5-star hotel stay if it's on offer, of course. So a bit of everything, but mostly backpacking. Yeah.
But why don't you contrast for us, for someone who's been on the road a very long time? What's the biggest difference in your perspective from traveling solo versus with your friend, family, or girlfriend?
I think when you're with a partner, suddenly things become a bit cheaper. You share meals, you share rooms, you share almost everything. You can even probably get cheaper bus and train tickets. And you can also, still have a little bit of freedom within that because as a big football fan, I would sometimes go to football, but if I'm traveling with friends, family, or my ex-girlfriend and they're not interested in football, they would go and do their thing. So I say saving money is probably, when you travel solo, you have to really be a lot stricter on your budget because you need to budget for just one person. And you have to maybe, I've ended up in a dorm on my own, or I've ended up in a twin room paying for the whole room because I didn't have anyone to share it with. Or I've ended up on a tour and I had to pay more money because there weren't enough people, you know, to join. So just things like that, I noticed different. As well, you meet more people when you're on your own because you open up and talk to people. When you're in a group that you already know, you tend to hang around with that group and you don't socialize so much with new people and strangers.
And Johnny, you're just referring to money and cost while being on the road. So let's expand that out a bit. Share with us how you've been supporting yourself on the road for so many years.
It all started when I lived in England. Basically, any job that comes up, I will take it. I'm not fussy. If it's cleaning the toilets for 2 days, you know, that gives me a day off to go hiking, I'll do it. If it's working in a bar in a remote village that nobody's heard of, I'll do it. So I'm not fussy with jobs. On the road, I've been working in broccoli farms. I've been working in Irish pubs quite a lot. I've worked in ice cream huts, in theatres, in hotels, on boats. I've had a very diverse working life on the road. But the last few years have been a bit different. Because I got into writing big time, and I secured a few writing contracts. So through those writing contracts, that's largely what I'm basing my travels on now. So I get paid to write, whether it's writing about football. It's normally football or travel. And also through my blogs, blogs these days, of course, get a lot of income through different advertising methods, sponsored posts, etc. So that's also a big part
So you have two big blogs that I'm aware of. So Northern Man, Northern Irishman in Poland, and don'tstopliving.net.
Yeah.
So give the listener an example of how you're able to drive income from your writing and photography on these websites.
Okay, so photography-wise, I'm terrible. I don't really concentrate on it. I concentrate on the writing. The promoting. Don't Stop Living was basically my idea of just a lifestyle blog of a guy that just, you know, I dreamed up this man that just wakes up every day and wants an adventure. So I based that website on the persona of myself, and I just wrote honestly and openly about every day of my life, where I was going, what I was doing. I went to some crazy places people hadn't heard of. And when you're doing that, of course, travel companies and advertisers get interested in it. So how did it bring money? Obviously, you get sponsored posts is an obvious one. But you also get a lot of offers to go on trips that are maybe sponsored. You've got sponsored trips, then you've got hotel stays, hostel stays, tours, all this on top of companies paying you.
Johnny, give us an example of one of your favorite sponsored trips where a brand or tourism board reached out to you and hosted you somewhere.
Well, Israel was a good example because I worked.
I'm sorry. Where?
Israel and Palestine.
Okay, great.
So both places together, because obviously when I'm in a region, I want to try and see everything. So I worked with Tourist Israel and also a hostel group in the country, which was Abraham Hostels. So I got to stay in about six different cities in the region, and each night was hosted. It was the busiest probably tour of my life, because I only got about 5 hours sleep. You know, I was up at 5 a.m. for the sunrise hike to Masada. We were out partying on the pub crawls in, like, Jerusalem, Haifa, and Nazareth. And you know, you didn't get much time for yourself, but it was absolutely scintillating in terms of, you know, the diversity of places to see. And also, I could write about it and get promotion. And later, of course, a lot of those articles I wrote are still good for my promotion, because people still read them, and also companies sometimes ask me to write a sponsored post about a destination that I've been. So I write it in a way where, you know, I've actually got my own photos and experience from there. So it's a real story, as well as being an outlet for advertising.
Johnny, you've covered a lot of ground over your years. Take me to one of your favorite places. It can be a city, a country. It can be a church or a desert. What, something that you always look back fondly on?
That's a really difficult question, obviously, because there are so many. So how do you narrow it down? Look, I can't ignore Machu Picchu in Peru after the Inca Trail. You know, I did a 4-day hike, and just when the mist cleared that morning, you know, just walking down the ascent down towards Machu Picchu, and you just see this ancient city just uncovered, exactly like what it looked like in all the books and all the photos I'd seen before. That was just a moment that you cannot replace it, because I could then feel that, yeah, I've been there, I've seen it with my own eyes, and it really is that good. So for sure, Machu Picchu. I think most people are astounded by the beauty of this city. And another place to talk about, a place where there are humans, Gdańsk in Poland. It's absolutely beautiful, underestimated tourist destination. You know, the beautiful old town, the Długi Targ, when you walk down to the harbor and you see the old, you know, it's on, almost like an old city that has just become so much more cool in the last 10 years. The amount of bars, restaurants and cafes now, the amount of people there, you know, it's going to become overrun by tourists. So Gdańsk, absolutely beautiful place.
Okay, Johnny, you shared with us two great favorite places. I'm now turning the tables on you. You have to tell me a place you really, really dislike.
Okay, country. I'm going to go country here. Venezuela, everything about it, from the people to the government to the border controls to the restaurants to the bars, I just didn't like it. It was just the most dangerous place I've ever seen in my life. I thought I was going to die, you know, every moment. From the moment I got to the border, the sort of Colombia-Venezuela border, and even just sitting on a bus, just looking around at people, just feeling that I'm a victim here of something. And I just could feel the destruction of my travel mindset. I just didn't feel like traveling anymore when I was in Venezuela. It sort of put me off. I didn't like it at all.
Okay, so you crossed the border from Colombia into Venezuela. What year was that?
2011. So okay. Chavez was still in control, and it was just so dangerous. I felt there was a riot about to start, and I was going to be just, I don't know, I was just going to be in the middle of it.
Johnny, so you're feeling in danger, you're feeling uncomfortable. How many days did you end up spending in Venezuela on that trip?
I only spent 5 days there, and it felt like 5 days too long. I was ready to leave after 5 minutes, so not a long time. Every second of every day was a disaster.
So I guess my thought or follow-up question is, why wasn't the trip 4 days?
Because I had to book a flight out, and I was also saving money. So I think the cheapest flight was on the fifth day on the morning. I wanted to like it, and I thought maybe that extra day will give me something amazing to see. And give me the opportunity to go away positively, but that didn't happen, unfortunately. So I ended up on the fifth day leaving, and it was not a happy one.
But there are no thoughts when you cross that border of basically heading right back to Colombia? You were going to kind of push through and see if your feelings changed about the country?
Definitely. I mean, I wanted to see San Cristobal, and I wanted to see Caracas. I also had plans to visit Merida, because in Merida they have the biggest ice cream shop in the world, and that was one of my reasons for going to Venezuela. And once I got to Caracas, I thought, there's no way I'm getting on buses to go to Merida. The threat of someone with a knife or a gun coming up to me when I'm only going there to eat an ice cream. So I just went into Caracas and had an ice cream, you know. Not a great time. But, you know, people like Venezuela. Some people go there and love it. So you can't use my opinion for anything other than what I thought and felt when I was there.
Was it a good ice cream?
4 out of 10.
Yeah. So Johnny, when you're in Venezuela for those 5 days, I mean, there's definitely a, you know, ill at ease feeling, but did you specifically have a dangerous situation or?
Yeah, a guy came up, tried to rob me at the time where I had the most amount of money and on me. And I was actually outside the Suriname embassy waiting on my visa. So I got my Suriname visa in Venezuela, but I was outside the embassy, came up to rob me. And I basically had to run fast down a hill just to get away from him. And I was on my own. Later the same day, I felt the same danger when I was going back to collect my visa when it was ready. I ended up having to pay for a taxi to come back, because as soon as I got that visa, I thought, someone's going to steal my passport here. I better get back to the hotel. So I actually got a taxi. A rare moment for me. I don't normally get taxis from an embassy to a hotel, but I did it.
Okay. Well, glad you're safe and sound. And speaking of dangerous situations, besides Venezuela, any other scary moments on the road? Any other situations where you're in danger?
I guess there would have been a few. Just trying to think, because I did visit places like Iraq and Afghanistan, but actually I find those to be quite safe. Going back to Northern Ireland, growing up there is probably the second most dangerous after Venezuela because of the amount of bombings and shootings we had back in the bad days, you know?
Okay. Yeah, so tell me about your experience in Afghanistan, because obviously that's going to have a reputation to the general public of being a violent, dangerous place. So you said you were backpacking through the stands and you ended up in Afghanistan. What year and how many days there?
It was 2016 and 3 days in Afghanistan.
And what were the highlights on that trip?
Basically, I had organized through a tour company to take me overland and show me. I will tell you, it was amazing. I went to Mazar-e-Sharif, the main mosque there. If anyone that's been to that blue mosque, it's absolutely beautiful. One of the nicest mosques in the world. Just on the other side of it, there's this park with all these white birds, and it just felt like a sign of peace. I then visited some of the places where the Afghan civil war took place, including a monastery in Samangan, and I visited... I actually played football in Afghanistan with the kids on the edge of Tashkurgan, and I also did a tour to Balkh, which is a really ancient city, and Zoroastrianism, the religion, was actually formed there. So I actually packed in quite a lot in the 3 days. I was given, a 3-month visa, and I only used 3 days because not only was the tour it was quite extreme and expensive, and also quite I guess I was seeing quite a lot in 3 days, but I had an entry visa for Uzbekistan, so I felt like I was wasting time of that as well. It was one of those quick trips across the border and back in, you know, through the same border crossing. But if anyone wants to go to Afghanistan, I recommend doing it overland from Uzbekistan. Just make sure you have a double entry visa, otherwise you won't get back in.
And is Afghanistan one of those countries that makes you, or you think about, you want to go back to?
Yeah, I would love to go back. I would actually, next time I would go to Kabul, or I'd do some hiking in the mountains. I know a lot of fellow tourists and travelers have done some of the hiking in the northern Afghan mountains. Some of my friends even went skiing there. So there's a lot to see. Obviously, with the threat of terrorism rife, people are put off. But, you know, you can get killed in your own town. So it's for me, it's nothing to be too scared of, because we don't know when our time's up anyway.
That's true. Johnny, how about an underrated country, somewhere you went, not any high expectations, but you got there and you thought it was fantastic?
Well, I have to be biased here, but Poland. For me, Poland is absolutely the nicest country in Europe outside of Northern Ireland. It's just so diverse. You've got mountains in the south. You've got bridges that were bombed by the Germans. You've got cities that old towns have been, you know, reconstructed. You've got the best bars, cafes, restaurants, non-commercial. You've got the coolest feasts and banquets you could imagine. You've got canal cities that are better than Venice. You've got castles. You've got the biggest castle in the biggest brick castle in the world. You've got here in Poland, we also have a huge amount of under-visited cities that just deserve to be seen. And I just sometimes I wonder, why do people not visit them? Like places like Bydgoszcz, like Lublin, Olsztyn, Starogard. People, tourists aren't going to these places. And if you come to Poland and escape Warsaw, Krakow, Wrocław, and Gdańsk, you can find so much beauty. You know, Poland even has this Hel Peninsula, which is a peninsula, but it's got its own beaches, and it's absolutely fascinating. If you see an image of Hel from above, it just looks like the most breathtaking place on earth. You would think, a lot of people think it's in the Maldives, or it's off the coast of India or the Philippines, but no, it's in Poland. And also on top of that, you've got beautiful, wonderful people and the Catholic churches, which is such a strong part of the culture here. So Poland, come and visit if you've never been. Please, people, it's amazing.
Okay, I'm sold. I'm coming back for my second visit. And say the name of that peninsula one more time.
It's actually called Hel, but it's spelled H-E-L, Hel Peninsula. Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous. It should be more popular, but it's not. You can do a day trip to Hel, we call it. You go from Gdańsk to Hel on a boat.
Okay, sounds pretty impressive. How about a worst moment from the road? One of those days you got so food sick, or you lost all your money, the bank ate your ATM card. Was there one of those just awful days on the road where you wanted to pack it all in and just head home?
I could probably name about 10 days like that. One that springs to mind was my fault. I was in Nagorno-Karabakh, and Stepanakert is the capital there. So I'd arranged to stay with a local family. But what you forget about places like Nagorno-Karabakh is they're excellent at making their own brandy and rum. So I got to this family, and on one night, I must have drank 1.5 bottles of brandy. It was absolutely disgraceful, the amount of alcohol I'd consumed. But these Karabakh guys, they were just drinking it like there was no tomorrow. And for me, when I woke up on that tomorrow, I couldn't move. And basically, I was lying on the street begging people to get me a bus back to the mainland of Armenia. And it took about 6 hours lying on the to try and get myself back up. Eventually, I got back to Armenia at midnight that night, and I remember just going to bed, and I slept for about maybe 18 hours solid, and the alcohol still felt it was in my system. So it was totally my fault, and I wanted to give up travel at that very moment, even though I was in one of the most obscure places I'd been in to that point. So that was one. If I can tell you another one, I was in Laos, or Laos, whatever people call it, doing the tubing in Bang Vieng. And I made the stupid mistake of taking all my money and my camera with me on the tubing, because I didn't trust the people in the hostel that I was sleeping in. I didn't trust to leave my money there. So I'd taken all my money with me, and I mean Thai baht, Lao, whatever the currency is, I can't remember now. Kip, Lao Kip. I also had some Cambodian currency. I had some US dollars and some, I think, Hong Kong as well. And I put that all in my wallet. I took my wallet with me tubing. Tubing is going into rivers when you've had a few beers. So you can imagine what happened. I got on the tube, this ring floating downstream, lost control. The ring turned over on its side. My wallet, camera, everything went into nature. And I swam to safety, looked at the beautiful world and thought, my goodness, I've just lost $1,000 plus all my photos, my camera, and of course all my credit cards. So I actually went back to the hostel and went to bed, and I couldn't even pay the bill for the hostel.
But you made one very happy person in Laos when they found all your belongings, but that's a pretty frustrating story.
Nobody would have found it, to be honest, Rick. It's gone to the bottom of the water in that stream, and it would have just floated down forever and ever. And, of course, I cancelled the bank card straight away, but they had even tried to use them because they're sitting at the bottom of a river somewhere.
So, out of curiosity, what's the warning sign for you? You're saying you didn't feel comfortable with the hostel and you had to take your belongings. What was the warning sign where you didn't feel comfortable with the hostel?
I guess if a window looks like it could easily be opened, if there is no locker, or if maybe I just have a bad feeling about the people working there. You know, generally I trust people too much, and that can be a real problem as a traveler, because we should be very wary and suspicious of people, but you know, because you don't really know who you're going to meet. So I guess I just, probably if I'd left my money in the hostel that day, it probably would have been okay, you know, but I didn't know that at the time. So
nope, you got to use your gut feeling and common sense. And out of curiosity, you go back to the hostel, you've lost everything. How did they treat you when you had to share with them you really didn't have any financial resources?
They understood it, and the next morning they still gave me a free breakfast and let me check out. And I was able to get money wired from my ex-girlfriend and my family both together on the next day through one of these agencies that sent money. So I then went to collect the money after I'd checked out, and I promised them I'd come back and pay them, which, of course, I was then able to do. So it was all rectified in the end, of course, but losing money is not great. Losing a camera with memories is worse, you know?
Yeah, frustrating. And Johnny, do you have a tip specifically for keeping your valuables safe, your monies, your passport, your smartphone? Do you have a trick or hack that you utilize to keep everything safe?
You know, to be honest, I trust only myself these days, so I carry it all with me. So if I'm out and about in a city, I'm likely to have those valuables on me. I'm quite lucky in that I've got two passports. So with the passports, I always leave one at the hostel and take one with me. So that means it's unlikely that I'll lose both of them. Photos, my tip is to make sure every night you upload or you save those photos onto a hard drive. So if it's something like a hard drive, I leave it in the hotel or hostel. But if it's a laptop or a phone, I'm taking those out with me in the daytime. I don't, if I'm on night trains, I always make sure like the door's locked, or I talk to the other people in my cabin to make sure I know them and trust them in some way. Because when I'm asleep or when someone's asleep, they could easily be stolen, which happens a lot on buses and night buses, night trains. Of course, it happens a lot.
Where are your passports from?
I've got an Irish one and a British one, and I would love to have a Northern Irish one, but we don't have that right yet. So I have to have a nice mix of both, you know.
Okay.
So the Irish one has real benefits over the British one, actually, because the Irish one is not seen as negative in too many places. Like Argentina, you know, because of the British and the Falklands had that problem. Again, with Iraq and Afghanistan, I use the Irish one. Pretty easy to get a visa. And then the British one comes in handy for sort of British places that you go, like the likes of, I don't know, say Bermuda, Australia, New Zealand. They go, oh, you're British, cool. You know, so both passports are really good ones to have.
Cool. But, looking back, Johnny, how about one of those challenging visa stories, one of those nightmare visa stories?
Oh, where do I start here? You know what? I'm not going to say Suriname, but I could say Suriname because, again, it was in Venezuela and it was a nightmare to get that Suriname visa. I will say Algeria because Algeria, the embassy in London kept refusing me a visa. So I applied with different passports, okay? I started with my British, then when they rejected it, I used my Irish. I actually ended up spending £1,700, British pounds, on my visa for Algeria, and I got 17 hours in the country on a transit visa accompanied by a guide. So basically, I don't have a lot of good things to say about Algeria. They asked me, the first time I went to get the visa, they asked me, have I booked my flights? Have I booked my hotels? I then paid for everything. I booked everything, the tour guide, everything, for 8 days. And they refused to give me the 8-day visa. So they gave me a 1-day visa, which meant that I had to leave the airport on the same day, basically. So I've seen sunrise and sunset in Algeria. But not a lot else. So that was an absolute nightmare. And for that reason, I don't really want to go back there.
I was just having this conversation with another traveler over the weekend. And it's, I just went to Algeria earlier this year for about 2 weeks. I had a fantastic experience and thought it was a great country. But something can affect your trip, which will give you a totally different opinion than the guy next to you. I mean, it could be as simple as, you know, I had bad weather the whole time I was there, or you had one sucky taxi drive away from the airport to your hotel. But your situation is obviously, that's pretty severe and really frustrating.
Yeah, and to be honest, when I look back on that, I probably could have paid a tour company £1,000 to just organize it all for me, but I was trying to do it myself. And by the time I looked at how much I'd spent, and also the woman in the embassy took a backhander, took money from me, and she hid that from the other staff working there. So I gave her an extra 20 quid to make sure it was processed by 5 p.m. You know, I mean, these type of things happen in Africa commonly anyway. But it was just a bit of a shock in London to see that happening, you know, because it's obviously a very civilized city. And I expected places like Algeria to be easy enough to get visas. Uzbekistan was also a real tough one.
Okay, Johnny, so you mentioned you got to go to Algiers, you saw sunrise, you saw sunset. So that leads me to my next question. Your rule, what counts as visiting a country? Is it the airport, a passport stamp, sleeping over, putting your foot over the border? What's your rule?
Yeah, this is a great question because I've listened to so many of your interviews and each person seems to have their own way of thinking about it. I have some selfish ones that don't really count, but I'll tell you them anyway. Watching a football match in a country is amazing. Having a beer and the local food is amazing. So if I've done those, I feel that I've been there. But generally, my favorite moment is when I actually get to that border and I get stamped in. And once I have that stamp, I feel, well, I could really leave now if I wanted because I'm here. But then I think, oh, let's go and explore and see how cool it is. So for me, probably the entry, once you've arrived in the country, you've got your stamp, you've got your foot over the border, and the world is yours, and nobody is following you, with probably the exception of maybe North Korea, where you're sort of on a guided tour, if you like. So, yeah, anything counts. And like Vatican City, you know, it's not on the UN list, but most people, I don't know anyone who's gone there for like a week. Apart from maybe the Pope or some really religious people. But there's no point in going there for a week, is there? I mean, you've seen everything after a day, surely.
Well, so I guess some could argue for the museum you need a week to see everything.
Well, it is a fairly big museum, yeah, in fairness. Yeah.
But, Johnny, any frustrations then where you're in a country, whether you don't pass through immigration or not, but you don't get the stamp? Any frustrations there, or, you know, you tried to hunt down a stamp, or you had to convince an official that they don't normally stamp and go, hey, please stamp this passport?
You know, that's a really interesting question because I do want to have a stamp from every place I go, but the EU countries can be particularly frustrating because even if you ask them for a stamp, often they don't give it. So I've been to probably about 40 to 50 countries on my list that I've never even had a stamp in. So while it's disappointing, I wouldn't say it's frustrating. It's just the way they are. You know, places like San Marino or Andorra, you can go out of your way and ask to get a stamp. I'm just trying to think if I ever got into a country illegally without a stamp where they should have stamped and they didn't. I guess Paraguay is a good example because when you go from Brazil into Paraguay, I remember crossing the border and I was on a bus and I had to basically shout to the front of the bus, can you stop, please? I'm a tourist. I need to get my passport. He was going to me straight away. And then I wouldn't have been legally in Paraguay. So when I went to leave, that would have been a problem. So that's the only real one that sort of sticks in my mind. And then, of course, I just went in to get my passport stamped in Ciudad del Este. And there's nobody there, right? So I'm waiting for 20 minutes for someone to just come and go. And he's like looking at me going, what do you want? Passport stamp, please. I'm in Paraguay, aren't I? And he's like, oh, you're in Paraguay. Where did you come from? Well, Brazil. There's only one other country there. So it's very interesting. But I got it, of course, and enjoyed that country actually as well, yeah.
I think that's a testament to the lack of tourists in Paraguay.
Probably, yeah.
Johnny, you've been on the road a long time. You've had some incredibly rich, incredible travel experiences. Is there a flip side to being on the road, living overseas? In other words, what's the sacrifice that you've made? Is it family? Is it friends? Is it marriage? Is it health? What have you missed out on?
I think, you know, if when you look back on your life, everyone looks back and then wants something of someone else, what someone else had. So, yeah, I've got friends that went to school with me and they're the same age as me, but they're married with children. They've got a car, a flat and a secure job. But they've never seen, you know, like 40 countries, never mind 113. So for me, I guess I lost the idea that of living a stable life. So I sacrificed a stable, kind of modern, you know, modern family life where I've got children, I've got a wife, and I've got a car and a flat, you know. So I sacrificed that. Another negative is it can be the health, you know. If you're traveling on your own, it's very easy to get depression. And it's happened to me numerous times on the road where I just have a bad moment and I just want to go and lie down in bed on my own and cry. There's ups and downs. No life is perfect, surely, you know.
So Johnny, if you feel comfortable sharing with us, how do you deal with those really down moments of depression when you might be by yourself in some random corner of some random country?
Unlike most people, I cut myself off from family and friends in those moments because I don't want any sympathy from them. I almost want to just try and fight this on my own corner. So if I'm in a hotel or hostel, I'll just turn the lights off and have a cup of tea and go to bed. And if I wake up in the morning and I still have it, then I've gone and seen experts. I've taken medicine for it. So there are different ways to deal with it. But I think, you know, overall, you've got to be prepared. These things can happen. You know, you can also get food poisoning as well, you know, when you travel a lot more than when you've got a stable life, because you're meeting new people. Depression, I think a lot of tourists and solo backpackers have had some kind of depression on the road.
Okay, thanks for sharing that. So, you know, you just touched on some of the challenges. Anything you would have done differently then so far, looking back on your travel career, so to speak?
That's a good question. I guess we can have a few regrets in life. I guess I lived in Australia for 2 years, but never once did I visit any of those like really remote country islands in the Pacific, you know, like Fiji, Tonga, Vanuatu, Papua New Guinea, Micronesia, Palau, Nauru, etc. I didn't go to any of those, yet I was in many cities that had a direct flight. I literally could have done a 4-day trip to Fiji, you know, in that 2 years, and I didn't. I just stayed in Australia. So I wouldn't say it's a total regret, because obviously I was working and I had a good life in Australia. Maybe when I look back, it would have been an easier and a cheaper way to see a lot of those remote countries that are on the list of places that I still have to go to now.
Yeah, well, they'll give you an excuse to head back and check out those islands.
Definitely.
So I know a ton of people read your blog, and you've inspired so many travelers. For example, Rambling Randy, who's been on Counting Countries. But what about you? So is there anyone that you read, you follow, that has inspired you in your travel life?
Definitely. I think we do look up to people. When I was a kid, or when I was, I'd say teenager, I don't know if you know, you're aware of Michael Palin?
That, I do not know that person.
Yeah. So Michael Palin, he used to do documentaries for the BBC where he would go to these really remote places and just meet with the locals. Very well-spoken guy. So definitely Michael Palin, one person who I'd obviously love to meet, but his travels were brilliant. And I actually copied him on some of his trips. Like, he went to this place in India, which was the only state in India where you can get a death penalty if you're drinking alcohol. So I went to places like that just to witness them, because he'd been. So Michael Palin, in terms of popular BBC sort of travel journalists, and then in terms of travel writers and bloggers, there's a Wandering Earl. I don't know if he's been on the series or not yet, but Derek Earl Barron, wanderingearl.com, excellent website, superb guy. Went out for a few drinks with him, and he's got a really good outlook on life. So definitely, he's one of the travel blogs, one of the few ones that I still read.
Yeah, any people in the 193 community that you're aware of or that you follow or that have inspired you?
Definitely. Again, I've actually Gunnar Garfors in Norway. I was in Norway about 2.5 years ago, and Gunnar was actually, I think at the time, he was the youngest hobby traveler to visit every country in the world. And he was just such a great guy. We basically just had a night out just talking about travel and football. So he's I think he's the first and only person that I met in that bracket, you know, of being everywhere. And yeah, definitely an inspiration, especially when you come from Norway, because it's not one of the more common countries that these 193 guys are from. A lot of them are British, Irish, or American, or Canadian.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I got to Gunnar's been on the program, and I also got to share a coffee with them earlier this year in Bangkok. So good guy, and I'm imagining you must have an answer for this next question. A memorable character from the road. So it could be a guy in one of those hostels. It could be that funny guy on the street corner, in, you know, something of that nature. So one of those people that epitomizes the magic of travel.
That's a brilliant question. There, I mean, I'm just looking back at different nights out that I've had in different places I've been. There were lots of just specific little moments, but maybe I only met these people once or twice, and it doesn't shoot out at me as one person. There is one person that I will mention, though, that is actually a friend of mine, and it's Sean Schofield. Sean actually has a different travel style from me, is that he goes to every single Northern Ireland football match, and he's been going to almost every match since about 1995 or 96. And he is a character because he dresses up in green. He does crazy things to get to these matches. So I think he's broken the record recently for the most number of Northern Ireland football matches in a row. And he's a character I always look forward to meeting up with when I travel. I've only met him, I guess, about 5 or 6 times, but each time it's always been a pleasure. And yeah, he's just planning his next trip. He just waits till the football fixtures come out, and then he plans his next trip.
And I'm not a football fan. I'm an American football fan. Go Patriots. So who is your team, Johnny?
I've got 3 teams. I've got my local team in Belfast, which is Glentoran. We play in the Irish League, top division. I've got my second favourite, my English team, because I lived in England for a long time. And it's AFC Bournemouth up the Cherries. They play in the English Premier League at the moment. And then I've got my national team, Northern Ireland. So with football, maybe a little bit different than American football, where I can have 3 teams because I lived in those 2 countries, so I have to support my national team. But I'll watch any match, any football match, I'll watch it.
Okay, cool. What are you most proud of? So you look at your travel accomplishments. Anything stand out in particular? Like, wow, I really happy or proud or impressed I was able to do this?
Yeah, I guess I like ticking off lists. I've been to over 100 national football stadiums with a flag that I carry. So that gives me a bit of pride because I'm not sure, but I don't think anyone else has actually done that with a Northern Ireland flag. So I've been to 100 national football stadiums, which makes me kind of proud because I love football and I love the fact that I'm in a new country and they've got a stadium and I sometimes live my way just to visit it. You know, it might be in the middle of nowhere. So I'm proud of that. I'm proud of the remote places that I've been, the unrecognized countries. I think I've been to 41 or 42 really unrecognized countries now. So that's definitely a list I'm probably more proud of than the usual places.
What, Johnny, pick out your favorite or weird or unique football stadium that you've checked out.
Wow, I was going to write about this once, about 5 craziest football stadiums. I don't know, have you been to La Paz in Bolivia?
I was just there in August.
Yeah, in La Paz, they've got the highest national football stadium in the world. It's literally just built into the city. And I went there on a quiet morning about 7 years ago. I just walked in and the door was open. I just walked in and there were people running, training, practicing on the pitch. And I was able to get on the pitch, kick a ball, touch the nets. And I felt amazing. I was actually inside the world's highest football stadium. And they'd just beaten. Yep.
Did you get winded from running and kicking?
No, not at all. I didn't have this sriracha or this altitude sickness at that time. But they actually managed to beat Argentina I think, 6-1 there. And nobody beats Argentina 6-1. But because of the altitude, the Argentinian players couldn't handle it, you know? So, yeah, that's definitely
a massive home field advantage when you're at 4,000 meters and the other team's not used to it. And looking at those 42 not recognized, unrecognized countries, again, pick one of your favorites from that list.
Ooh, that is tough. I mean, this, we talked about the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. That would be one of them. But I think Transnistria does stand out because it's just so obscure. I mean, it feels like a part of the Soviet Union still. It's almost like you've just gone back in time. And you can see these ridiculous bus stops and post boxes that just don't exist anymore anywhere else. And the fact is, you know, they've got one pizza restaurant there. And, you know, the locals rave about how good the pizza is. But if you compare that to any, you know, pizza restaurant anywhere in the world, the pizza is very, very rubbish, actually. So it does make me laugh. Although in all respect, it's a great country and a great place, and I recommend people going to Transnistria.
Yeah, I agree. I had a pretty cool experience when I went to visit the country. But Johnny, so you're at 113. What are your thoughts? Plan, strategy to visiting the next 80 of them?
So with me, it's a very much work in progress and steady movement. I don't want to just bombard myself with 80 countries in like a year or two. So I take it quite slowly. Being based in Poland at the minute means that I can sort of geographically look at the most feasible ones from here that I've yet to visit. And the worst, I guess, probably personally, I haven't really cracked much of Africa yet. So for me, I'd probably have to do some kind of road trip, backpacking adventure for 4 or 5 months and just pray that I can get all the visas I need and go through a load of countries in a short time. Coming up, I'm probably looking at visiting the rest of the Middle East and maybe finishing off the European and North African countries for now. And then further down the line, the Pacific Islands and the Caribbean and Saudi Arabia, which is everyone's normally one of the most difficult places to visit.
That is a tough one. Okay, Johnny, I want to thank you so much for your time today and joining me and sharing your awesome travel stories.
No worries. It's great to be here. And I look forward to hearing lots more of the cool interviews on the series. Cheers, Rick.
Okay. And Johnny, before you go, how can people stay in touch with you and follow your travels?
Okay. So at the moment, I have a niche in Poland. I write about Poland. The website is www.northernirishmaninpoland.com. And if you want to see about my global travels, we go to Don't Stop Living, which is don'tstopliving.net.
Okay. Johnny, thank you for sharing that. And again, thank you for joining me on the program. Safe travels for the rest of this year and into 2018.
Thanks a lot. Cheers, Rick.
Thanks to Johnny for joining me on Counting Countries. It was great to get to know him a little bit better. Please consider subscribing to Counting Countries. And if you're inclined, write a review. Also, I love hearing any of your feedback, even if it's bad. So feel free to reach out to me on social media. Until next time, safe travels and keep on counting countries.
You have been listening to Counting Countries, the only podcast to bring you the stories from the dedicated few who've spent their lives on the singular quest of traveling to every country in the world. Our theme music is Demeter's Dance, written, performed, and provided by Mundi. Get their entire discography at mundiworld.com, mundiworld.com. And keep up with Rick and his own personal travel quests at globalgaz.com.